tonight on Arena. Paul Brady on songs and music in the plays of Sean O'Casey, and Peter McKenna, co-creator of Kin, on the new Sunday night drama on RTE Television. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In 1979, songwriter Paul Brady released the album The Green Crow Cause, featuring music from the plays of Sean O'Casey. Sean O'Casey's daughter, Siobhan, asked Paul to arrange music for her from her father's plays. The recording features, amongst others, the late piper Seamus Ennis with songs and spoken words performed by the renowned Irish actor John Kavanagh. A labour of love for Paul at the time, and this month he releases a remastered version of the 1979 album. I'm delighted to have Paul in studio with me this evening. You're laughing, Paul, is it when I say 1979?
Yeah. Paul Brady wasn't even a songwriter then. You know, I'd just come out of a decade of traditional music and had just done an album the previous year, Welcome Here, Kind Stranger, and I hadn't really done any songwriting at all. This was a really nice crossover project, which kind of eased me into a more complex form of writing and arranging music, and it was something that was a great pleasure to do.
That's interesting that when you can look back at it now, you see it as a kind of a bridge from one side of your career into another.
Well, I should say is that I'm not singing on this record at all.
Yeah.
The singing is done wonderfully by John Kavanagh, our actor, our singer here. And I really was brought in to be musical director, to arrange songs in whatever way they... to arrange songs and to write melodies where none existed. Because a lot of the texts were taken from Sean's autobiographies, and some of them came from other publications, not necessarily from his plays, that didn't have any music. So that's what I did. I put the music to it and arranged it, and got a lot of help because it was all new to me, that kind of thing. Sean Davey helped me a lot with the arrangements and all that, because I was a total newcomer to it.
To that side of things. Let's have a listen to one that I think has a particularly, I suppose, maybe the traditional side of you is very present in this particular composition, because it is an original composition, White Legged Mary, and as you say, the performer is John Kavanagh.
Your Gatling gun, old sailor boy, said White-Legged Mary, is aimed at my poor ship ahoy, said White-Legged Mary. I see it coming through the gloom, as big as any ship's jaboom, demanding a delicious doom for White-Legged Mary.
A little bit there of White Legged Mary, and that's one of the songs on Paul Brady's 1979 album, The Green Crow Cause, remastered this year. And Paul with us in studio talking about all around texts from Sean O'Casey and setting them to music. Just listening to that, they're pulling in the saxophone into what essentially has a quite a bawdy traditional song.
He was quite bawdy. You know, I was trying to find out, you know, what I could do in terms of writing for brass and stuff like that. And, you know, the tune just was something that just came to me. And it was all a learning process.
And the idea of the saxophone, you were saying that Sean Davey had been, been a help along in the arranging of things.
You know, when I was asked to arrange stuff from the kind of Edwardian period or something like that, you know, that would have involved instruments, you know, classical instruments that I didn't really...
Cellos, violins.
Yes, violins and all that.
You know, than fiddles and guitars.
Trumpets and, you know,
clarinets, oboes, all that sort of stuff.
I didn't even know the ranges of those instruments at the time, you know. I mean, so although I might have heard music in my head, I didn't know whether the instruments could actually play that. So Sean Davey helped me a lot in the earlier part of that process. And in fact, he arranged one of the songs.
I'm wondering, is that the one that I'm going to go to? Which is it the music hall one I picked up?
I tucked up my sleeves. My Bodice Neat and Modest is the one that Sean Davey arranged.
Sorry, that's the one I was thinking of. Which is a real theatrical feel to it. How familiar were you with Sean O'Casey and the work of Sean O'Casey, the theatrical side of things?
Well, I'd seen all the big plays, you know, anytime they came to Dublin. I love the theatre and I'd seen them. But I wasn't... I wasn't like conversant with every word he wrote or anything like that. And music was the whole thing for me. And it was just great to, but I mean, I had grown up listening to all that kind of music, like, I mean, Edwardian music and music in the 20s, 30s and 40s. And I was, the challenge to me was to take from the rhythms of his speech and then bring that to music which was redolent of the Edwardian era.
And the one that I was thinking about is, you're right, it is My Bodice, Neat and Modest. And it quite definitely, this is a real theatre piece. You could be in the music hall.
Yeah, it is.
And John Kavanagh, no better man. Let's have a listen.
My Bodice, Neat and Modest, oh, it's slipping, sir. Be careful, sir, be careful, please. The silken thread that holds it up is ripping, sir. Oh, do be careful. There now, it's down about me waist. My fairly goods are all uncased. I hope that tempered to your taste. St. Patrick's Day in the morning.
St. Patrick's Day in the morning covers a multitude there, really,
it does,
doesn't it?
It does, absolutely.
Again, Paul Brady with me this evening speaking about this CD or album of songs of Sean O'Casey, music from texts by Sean O'Casey. The Green Crow Caws, the title of the album. John Kavanagh really gets that kind of Dublin music hall feel perfectly there, doesn't
he? He's the perfect singer for this project because a lot of the texts are theatrical in nature and that's his place. But he's a great singer of that style of singing, the old style of singing, and it just makes the record happen.
Yeah. I mean, and as I listen to it now, I'm not hearing 1979, or I suppose 1978 is probably when you did it, but in and around, we're talking the late 70s, you know, I know that music and that style has a kind of timeless feel to it, but was there something about now that sent you back? Because it didn't really get the traction that you wanted at the time.
Well, there were other styles of music. There are other styles of music on the record. There's one which is kind of 60s folk rock, which was kind of my version of Fairport Convention or something like that, you know. And, I mean, the record, when it came out first, it came out on a UK major label. And I don't think their marketing department knew whether it was theatre, whether it was literature, whether it was ethnic Irish or what it was. And it kind of fell through the cracks in the beginning. And it just disappeared for decades. And I always, you know, I mean, when it came out first, a lot of people liked it. And I thought it was a shame that the record wasn't available. Yeah. So that's why we've
decided to make it available right now.
Yeah.
It also has, it's not all, there's some spoken word in there as well. And again, having John Kavanagh at the helm for this was a great boon, I would have thought. And this is one of the tracks that features the late Seamus Ennis. It's an lament for Thomas Ashe. O'Casey was a big friend of Ashe.
Yeah.
So let's have a listen to a bit of that.
Oppression of the bloody hands. You cannot put a rope around the neck of an idea. You cannot put an idea up against a barrack square wall and riddle it with bullets. You cannot confine it in the strongest prison cell that your slaves could ever build.
The breasts of the mountains with anger are heaving.
That's part of Lament for Thomas Ashe from the album we're speaking about this evening, The Green Crow Caws. 1979 album has been remastered and now re-released by Paul Brady. It's powerful stuff, that. Tell me about, you were explaining to me that I was asking you, it's Seamus Ennis that we hear piping on that track, Paul. I was asking you, did you compose the tune?
Well,
what way did you do that?
I wrote a tune, and the tune, I had it couched in a kind of a sort of classical Edwardian style of harmonies and movements and all. And I made a little demo of that. And I knew Seamus well because we would meet regularly quite often in Donoghue's in the afternoon. I sent him the tape and he came into the studio. He said he liked it, and he also was a big fan of Thomas Ashe and knew he was a piper. And so he came into the studio, and I was expecting him to sort of fit in with a kind of an arrangement, but he started to play just on his own, and he had moved it down one whole tone, which made it very modal, and it was just so magical that we thought, you know, hey, it doesn't need anything else except this and John Kavanagh's voice.
And it really works well. Visiting something like that 42 years or whatever on, and what's that feeling like, Paul? I mean, do you see and hear your old self or your younger self when you go back to work like that?
I do. Yes, it was a difficult record for me to be involved in, because it coincided with the birth of my son at the time, and in fact around about the same time exactly, and so there was I found myself under a lot of pressure because I had booked stuff in advance. And of course the timing went all wrong, so I was trying to keep a whole load of balls in the air
at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, it must be lovely to go back and remember a time like that then, 42
well,
years.
Well, it is. It's nice to listen to it and not sort of feel, oh.
It has to be a success. What's going to happen to my career from here?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I'll finish up with one of the tunes, the one I mentioned earlier, I tucked up my sleeves. And this is O'Casey himself suggested the use of the Donnybrook Fair jig here.
Yeah. So he had already used that in his play. And it was just up to me to arrange it again.
Well, let's finish up by listening to that. Great to see you this evening, Paul. Thanks for coming in.
The hawthorn shook all her perfume upon us. Red poppies saluted wherever they grew. The joyous exertion that flaunted before me when I tucked up my sleeves for the fasten or shoe. And what's it to anyone, whether or no? I learned in that moment far more than I knew. As she lifted her petticoat shyly and slow, and I tucked up me sleeves for to fasten her shoe.
I tucked up me sleeves, performed there by John Kavanagh, and that from the album we've been speaking about this evening, The Green Crow Cause, music from the plays and texts of Sean O'Casey, released on PB Music. Paul Brady with us this evening, and great to have you. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
For those of you who have made a Sunday night date with kin on RTE1 television, here's a teaser from this Sunday night show.
Moore's on a session with his mates. He's just sitting there.
You sure you want to do this on the day we buried Jamie?
It's fucking karma.
Amanda?
Moore knows it's Jamie's funeral and he thinks we'll be distracted by that. That's why he's out. When will we get another chance like this?
Oh dear. Jimmy, played by Emmett Scanlon, Michael, played by Charlie Cox, Amanda, played by Claire Dunn, conspiring to get Caelan Moore, Lloyd Cooney, the actor there, and he is Caelan, the man who killed Jamie. Looks like things are certainly going to get rough on Kin, RTE's new crime drama, which airs on Sunday night. And I'm sure there'll be more language like we just heard in the midst of that clip as well. If you haven't got on the Kin wagon just yet, it's the story of the Kinsella crime family set in Dublin. The Kinsellas live fast, glamorous lives with fast cars, open plan homes and designer threads. But it's all built on a nasty crime racket that they too are only pawns in. Kin has garnered both critical praise and political criticism for glamorising crime. Delighted to be joined by writer of Kin in studio this evening, Peter McKenna. Episode 3 coming up on Sunday evening. Peter, we thought it might be a good idea to get you in to talk about the series, just as it's now beginning to really gain momentum, I think, in terms of where we are. But for people, there was lots of talk about family trees. It was tweeting about family trees and who the Kinsellas are and where they all fit in. Let's kind of, can you set out the family tree for me?
Yeah, I can actually. And listen, I understand why people would think that. I guess we didn't help ourselves with all the beards. That kind of made them look alike. But there is, of the older generation still in the show, there is Aidan Gillen, who plays Frank Kinsella, and he has a son called Eric. There is his sister, played by Maria Doyle Kennedy, who's Birdie Goggins. And then they have another brother called Bren Kinsley, who makes an appearance later in the show. And he has two sons called Michael and Jimmy.
And the Michael and Jimmy are the Charlie Cox and Emmett Scanlon.
Exactly. And they're cousins of the Sam Keeley character, Eric Kinsley. Mm.
And it's Michael who's just out of prison.
And it's Jimmy who's married to Claire Dunn's character, Amanda Kinsella. And Amanda and Jimmy have just lost a son in the first episode.
Yeah, and from very early on, we get hints that Amanda knows both brothers perhaps a little better than most sisters-in-law might know.
Yeah, we do. And if you and if you watch episode 3, which I hope all your viewers will, you'll get more of that. So yeah. It's worth tuning in to see what happens.
Okay. It was Braun TV who asked you to come up with this series. So where did the Kinsellas and the Cunninghams, who are the other families, which is his name's gone straight out of my head now. Ciarán Hinds, yes. Yeah. The Ciarán Hinds character is at the head of that family. Where did the idea of these two families come from?
Well, really, I suppose, like, I was in a very lucky position that Braun Studios, or an American studio, were setting up they'd make films traditionally, and they were setting up a TV wing, and they wanted to start making TV shows. And with RTE on board very early, one of the execs in Braun kind of said to me, like, what would you like to write about? And I wanted to make a show about a Dublin family involved in crime. And that was the starting point. It was building the crime, building the family at the heart of it. And I'd kind of, like, I suppose, I'd read an article a few years ago, I suppose, 2017, on Vice website. And it was about how we deal with kind of criminals in Ireland and how we kind of turn them into celebrities. That was basically, it was an outside view going, isn't it funny how the Irish people, they give them nicknames, they're in the papers, we report how they dress and what they do, and they're almost treated like celebrities or reality stars in Ireland. And that kind of interested me, because I would be somebody who would have read books about this world and read the articles and all this. And the more I began to research or look into this, what really struck me is these people are projected and portrayed in films and TV dramas as having incredibly glamorous lives. Like, you know, when you watch Goodfellas or you watch whatever, you get the buzz and the excitement. And there's a part of you, I suppose, a lot of viewers are going, I wish that was me. I wish I could have that glamorous. But when you actually read about them in real life, a lot of the families I'd read about who were involved in gangland, you know, one member of the family would be serving 20 years in jail. Another person would have been killed. Another person could have died of an overdose. And what really struck me was the incredible amount of trauma, emotional trauma, these families went through.
It's interesting, though, that you take up this idea of, you know, that we place them as pop stars, or this was what this article was maintaining anyway, that we give them this kind of celebrity status. Yet it was that very aspect in some ways of the show that the Christy Burke, the inner city councillor, talked about, the glamorising side of what you're doing in the series.
But in fairness, Christy Burke kind of made those comments before he'd really seen the show. So he was making, like, he was reading articles about the show and then making comments on something he hadn't really seen. And, like, what we had tried to do is we had tried to present the family and then show the grief of the debt. So, like, what a lot of, I suppose, like, and I must say, I love gangland shows. I love kind of gangster movies, gangster TVs. I'd watch them all. But one of the things they do time and time again is people get shot and the story moves on without really taking a pause to think, what does debt mean? What are the consequences of all this violence and whatever? And I think in some ways, you know, what we've tried to do, sometimes at the expense of the shootings and the violence, is show like there are real consequences for violence. There is real consequences when people die. Like, and this continues throughout the show, that, like, when people are hurt, when people are killed, other people are left behind to grieve, other people hurt, and that motivates things. And what really interested me about taking on this project was, like, the trauma and the lives these people live that on the surface seem really exotic and seem really exciting, but at the very heart of it, it's a really, really tough life.
What kind of shadow, if that's the right term, did love-hate cast on a series like this? Because while we're in slightly different worlds, there are lots of overlaps between the world of love-hate and the world of kin.
Well, look, firstly, I would say, like, I watched Love-Hate every Sunday night like everybody else. I loved Love Hate. As I said, I like that genre. It was a really enjoyable experience for me. I'm also like, you know, I live in Ireland. I see how beloved it is. I'd say that and possibly Normal People are the best TV dramas we've made in probably my lifetime in Ireland. You know, they're certainly the most beloved and they've made the most impact. So when you're sitting down to come up with a story, of course you're aware of that. But for me, that wasn't enough of a reason not to write a story I wanted to write. If every time I came up with an idea, I think, well, I'm not going to do it because someone else has done something similar, you'd never write anything.
Did you find yourself, though, trying to be, you know, trying to go a different route, trying to look at a different aspect of that particular world?
Well, probably yes, in truth. There was different things that we tried to do. I wanted to tell a family story. That was the first thing. And then when I sat down to write about it, I focused more on the family relationships and the relationships within this family with the different characters. What you know, I probably have avoided doing is just play it with young men in a gang being gangsters and living out that gangster life. And I'm sure for a lot of viewers who tune in, that's what they want. And in some ways, Kin mightn't be what they want or mightn't be the thing they're expecting, and that'll be an adjustment for them. But like, you know, I don't think I deliberately sat down and said, I'm going to write. If I was doing that, I would have written a different show entirely. Yeah, I wouldn't have done something quite close. But like, you know, I understand why people are so attached to Love 8. I understand why it's so beloved. And I understand that the place it kind of holds in people's lives, cultural lives in Ireland. But as I said, like, you know, that's not a good enough reason to not writing something.
I mentioned Ciarán Hinds, and you've given us the family tree of the Kinsellas, essentially, there. The Ciarán Hinds family, the Cunninghams, we're in a totally different space when it comes to that family.
Yeah, we really are. And like, when we were thinking about it in the beginning and we were talking about it, we had kind of said, like, you know, this is a kind of like, a conflict between, like, Tesco's on one hand and a corner shop on the other.
The Ciarán Hinds family being the Tesco's.
An international, huge organization with, like, you know, tentacles across different countries, with loads of money, loads of resources, loads of, you know, everything that he needs. And then you have a small family-based group who are operating within a section of Dublin. And it was really meant to be like these, it's David and Goliath. It's a huge organization and a small one, and they go to war with each other.
Let's listen to a scene from episode one, which gives us a sense of the dynamic between Aidan Gillen as Frank at the head of the Kinsella family and Ciarán Hinds as Cunningham. Interesting, the kind of the power, where the power is at this moment in the series, at any rate, in season one.
Quaylan Moore has been encroaching.
He's young, enthusiastic. You remember what that was like?
Well, he burnt out two of our dealers. They can't have that, Eamon.
Look, Quaylan gets all his product from me. He's not using other suppliers, not like you do. I have to repay loyalty with loyalty.
You and I have been doing business since before Moore was born, and no one shifts as much product for you as we do.
It's not personal, Frank. Just the model's changing. You're either all in with me or you're not.
There we go, Ciarán Hinds and Aidan Gillen in a scene from episode one of Kin, and Peter McKenna, co-creator of the series, is with me in studio this evening. Also, there's a kind of an element, you know, a lot of people, when you think of Love Hate, you think of Nidge, but you'll also think of John and John Boy and Aidan Gillen in there. Was that on your mind, or did you just think, no, there's too much in this actor to let that get in my way?
Yeah, like, it would have been on my mind a little bit, to be honest, to create a different world with different characters. But as you said, when we came to casting and we were working our way through, and in truth, you know, Frank was one of the last characters we cast in the show, like one of the last main characters. And it was just a very hard kind of part to fill, because he's the head of the family, but he's like a pragmatic man. He's not a traditional gangster boss. In some people's view, he's weak.
He sounds as if he's in a weak position there, but I'm aware it's episode one.
Yeah, but he is quite pragmatic, and he tries to do, and he's the kind of man that we feel that, like, you know, power has been thrust upon him rather than him really seeking it out, and he's living. But like, when we were casting then, the pandemic struck and a lot of TV shows closed down around the world, and a lot of actors came back, and somebody like Aidan Gillen, who is scheduled to do a play and wouldn't have been available to us, certainly suddenly became available. And that opened up lots of options for us. And I think Maria Doyle Kennedy as well was another actor who probably wouldn't have been available to us without the pandemic.
Ciarán Hinds is in there too. Now, I know when we were talking about having seen the first episode earlier, I think it was last week, or it would have been because it was just after the first episode, the reviewer was saying, I want to see more of Ciarán Hinds. Surely he's going to do, because we've seen not that much of him really in the first two episodes. I'm presuming, as it goes on for eight episodes, in fact, that we will see more.
Yeah, he does. And like he grows, particularly as the show goes on, he gets bigger. And there is even like an episode where it would be from his point of view, where he's almost the main character and we follow his journey. And like Ciarán was the first person we cast. And like, I was really, really, you know, fortunate that like at the very beginning, we went out and Bron got him. And he was just amazing. But like what I found was I was writing the episodes and I had already cast Ciarán as Eamon, and I probably got to about episode four and I thought, like, you know, he's playing very little in each episode and often playing the same kind of thing, and we're underusing him. And like, we have another four episodes, let's just get much as we can out of him. And he is brilliant.
Will the Maria Doyle Kennedy character grow as well? It strikes me as one that has legs, if you
like. Yeah, they all grow a little bit. Like, they all grow. And particularly the one that grows the most probably is Claire Dunne's character, Amanda. And she does. But like, as the show goes on and the family are holed up on their street and, you know, under siege from the greater kind of gangland, you begin to see more of all the characters and the dynamics within the family and, you know.
And the Charlie Cox character, who's been kind of front and centre. That's a great casting to get as well. Like, phenomenal TV career behind him.
And we were really, we were really lucky to get him. What really happened was, His wife is an executive producer with Bron. She's on the show. She had the scripts at home. We didn't approach him, but he started reading the scripts and then thought, actually, this is what I really want to do. You know, and he gave up another show to come here and do this.
The accent is perfect. Yeah. One final question, because I have to get out of him and do other things. You have eight episodes in season one. Is there a season two? Do you already know? Can you say?
Well, we don't know for certain. We hope there is. We're already writing it, but like, ultimately, the decision will come, I suppose, in the next month or two as we see how the show has landed in America. Mm. It seems to be doing very well, and how it's done here, and it seems to be doing well. But we have to wait and see. We don't know for sure yet.
All right. Well, listen. Thanks for coming in to us, Peter, and sharing your thoughts with us this evening. That's Peter McKenna talking about Kin. It continues on Sunday nights, episode 3, this Sunday, RT1 Television at 9:30. And so to album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be one of Ireland's most successful singer-songwriters of the last decade, James Vincent McMorrow. Album number 5 has arrived. It's called Grapefruit Season. Next up will be the duo of singer-songwriter and lyricist Paul Noonan and electronic producer Doughty, who spoke to Houseplants earlier in the week. New album is called Dry Goods. And finally, public service broadcasting art pop three-piece from London released their fourth album, which is called Bright Music. Andrea Cleary and Eamon Sweeney have been listening. They're both with me in studio this evening. Let's start with James Vincent McMorrow. And this is how the album opens, track called Paradise. So pretend that we're surrounded, and pretend I got what it takes to drive us out of town, love, and run away the other bodies, cause I never wanna be like them. Never knowing if I'll keep you safe, never loving like we got no break. Pretend that we're surrounded by this paradise. Paradise, the title of the track from Grapefruit Season, a new album from James Vincent McMorrow. And as I said, Andrea Cleary and Eamon Sweeney are reviewers with me on this Friday evening. Spoke to James Vincent McMorrow about the album a couple of weeks back. It's hard to pin him down across his career to date, really. He almost changes from album to album, you could say, Andrea.
He does, yeah. He kind of started out in the beginning back in 2010 as this sort of singer-songwriter, very acoustic guitar-driven Bon Iver was a big touch point at the time, and then sort of moved more into electronic sound, maybe a bit more James Blake-ish. And I think this one is, this is his fifth album now, and this is, I think, the bid for the crossover into the mainstream, and I think you can definitely hear that on the song.
Yeah, he there. Seems to be going for a bigger market. And what is he singing about in the midst of this kind of, I suppose, I don't know if accessible is quite the right word, but certainly a more radio-friendly, more pop-friendly sound that he's given us here. But what's he singing about, Eamon?
Well, there's a very kind of, well, I find quite an interesting track called Gone, and it's kind of, I suppose, like this kind of a gentle hip-hop R&B undertones to it. But he sings about, you know, not taking things as seriously as he used to. And also doing less drugs than he used to, but still doing a lot. I think it's quite a playful record. I wouldn't take all this stuff very, very, very literally, but it definitely, he's both lyrically and musically come a long way from, you know, I suppose about roughly a decade ago when he started moving up, working up from Whelan's, doing other voices, ticking all those boxes, like so many other singer-songwriters. He's certainly widened his sonic palette a lot. His lyrical palette.
One of the things he said to me that I found quite interesting was it was that he just wanted to have more fun with what he was doing. You know, he said like he found that perhaps he was being terribly serious about everything, which is where this idea of the grapefruit season comes and his mother on a grapefruit diet when he was growing up, that was the kind of, she was doing the right thing. Do we get that sense of fun? Do you feel that he's more expressive of himself, just saying what he wants to say, Andrea?
I think, yes, to a certain extent, that's true. There's a lot of fun on kind of maybe side one of this record. The first four-ish tracks are like the track we heard there, very high energy, experimental, but friendly to the charts.
I'm hearing a but at the end of that.
There's a but that comes right in the middle of the record. Unfortunately, there's a string of three tracks: Waiting, Poison to You, and We Don't Kiss Under Umbrellas like we used to, that just completely take the wind out of the sails, and just like you've flopped a wet fish down on the table. I don't know why they're in the middle of the album like that. I feel like maybe they could have been better placed, maybe further on into the album. But when I got to those three tracks, I just thought, there's my energy gone now, you know.
Well, let's listen to the We Don't Kiss Under the Umbrellas like we used to get a sense of what you're talking about.
And I don't do a lot of things that I said that I would do. It reminds me I got yards to go and miles to prove. We don't kiss in umbrellas like we used to. And all I know is I can use some sleep, so just wait another week, and I'll come back as something that resembles you.
That's a little section there of We Don't Kiss Under Umbrellas Like We Used To from James Vincent of Morrow's new album, Grapefruit Season. Andrea Cleary saying there, Eamon Sweeney, about the air kind of being pulled out of the album for her there. And I did, to be fair, there's a very long guitar intro that I had playing underneath. This must be a good 30, 45 seconds of it. Now, is it a breather on the album, or did it have the same effect for you as it did for Andrea?
It had a very, very similar effect, because it's not just that track, it's kind of three in a row. And after one, you go, okay, we've slowed down proceedings, it's going to be something a bit different. And then it just gets too stuck in that groove for three quite lengthy songs. You're kind of going, what?
So if they'd been separated out, placed apart, if the track listing was different, would that have helped?
I don't know. I honestly wouldn't particularly rate any of those three tracks individually.
And the others?
Yes and no. Like, I do like what he's trying to do. I don't think I'm the target audience for it. It's not really to my taste. But I do kind of admire him somewhat for doing that. But
overall, does the album work for you? Because that's where you're going.
It's very middling for me. It doesn't really work for me. I can see why it worked for others. It is interesting, and I suppose, you know, going back to what Andrea is saying, this weird sequencing. This is a major label album now. It's on Columbia Records. Like, he started on Faction, like a Dublin label. and it's, I don't know, or maybe those three tracks are going to be the three hits. Maybe yeah, we're the knows? Ones right, that are deaf.
Stars,
I don't know.
Stars from you, Eamon.
I'm saying middling, so I'll go with 2.5.
2.5. Where are you on it, Andrea?
Just on those three records, I do think Poison to You, while it's not to my taste, I do definitely think that it could capture the attention of listeners to yeah. maybe Gavin James or Dermot Kennedy. And it should be a hit on radio, I reckon, but there's no accounting for taste. For me, it's 3 stars because I think what's good on this record is very, very good. But what kind of takes the wind out of it is enough to knock
does
2 stars off.
Too much harm for you. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Right. That is album number one in our three tonight. Jim's Vincent McMorrow and Grapefruit Season. Let's move on to Houseplants and their album Dry Goods. Houseplants, Dahi O'Droni, Dahi, and singer-songwriter Paul Noonan of Bell X One. Here's a very celebratory track called Campanero.
You're still sleeping. I'm just staring at your face. I guess it's kind of creepy, but I'm in a better place.
Campanero from Houseplants and their new album Dry Goods. Andrea, Paul Noonan, Bell X One, Dahi, electronic and dance music producer and player himself. Separately, they're brilliant. Together, how are they?
Together, it's like a whole new sound for both of them, really. This is uncharted territory for both Noonan, who I don't think he's forayed much into the electronic market. And for Dahi as well, who first worked with Noonan on a beautiful track called Take the Wheel on his debut record. And it really is. I mean, I was listening to an interview with the two of them during the week. And I think it was Paul Noonan said that together they're so much more than the sum of their parts. And I think that sums it up.
Yeah, they were in with me earlier in the week here as well. And the two of them sitting opposite you really got a sense that they were very at ease with each other, and that really it was that they were almost finishing each other's sentences in the way they seemed to be finishing each other's songs.
Yeah.
And it is bigger than just either of them separately.
Oh, definitely. And you can hear that on this album, that there definitely is an understanding there between them. They complement each other really well.
And yet
it doesn't sound like a debut record. Yeah. You know, it sounds like guys have been, you know, crafting this for a long, long time, which they have, but individually. So it's a really, really interesting, quite remarkable record, actually. Like, you know, and, you know, I suppose it's one of these opportunities thrown up to musicians. And I suppose Paul has been extremely busy of late and, you know, contributing to all sorts of things. Obviously, listeners will know him, be very familiar with him from Bell X One. And I do kind of think in that track, Windowpane, with the melody of it, and going, okay, this is not a million miles away from something like Rocky Took a Lover from Bell X One in terms of its melodic sensibility. Mm. So I do see some kind of continuum there, but it's dramatically different, certainly in ways.
Well, let's have a little listen to Windowpane, and I'll come to you then, Andrea.
I could tell it was you. The quiet complaint to the floorboard. Yeah, you know all the sweet spots, and I can hear your eyes. They rolling out loud, they rolling out loud. Look at this here window pane. I can breathe some breath and write your name. Look at this here window pane. I can breathe some breath and write your name.
That's Windowpane from Houseplants and their debut album, Dry Goods. Andrea, I was saying as we were listening to that, when I spoke with Paul Noonan and Dahi earlier in the week, I mentioned specifically to Paul Noonan the tracks when the piano comes in and it's there, it seeps in and out across the album. That makes it a very unique sound.
I think so, yeah. I think in the moment we just heard there, it really centres him. You really get a sense of him in that space. I think it's a very visual album. And when that piano comes in and he's saying, look at this here window pane, you can visualise him doing that. You can visualise him sitting by a window and writing this song on a piano. It's wonderful.
And does the piano do enough to pull it away from the Talking Heads of the LCD comparisons?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, LCD Sound System are no strangers to a good piano either. But I think, look, LCD Sound System comparisons are inevitable with this record. Like But it's fine. You know, there are worse things you can be compared to. Absolutely. Like, I mean, Companiero that we heard earlier, I definitely hear a lot of all my friends from LCD Sound System. But I think that this is a bit more than that. Like, I think Paul Noonan's lyrics throughout it, I mean, there's these brilliant Irishisms, which he's always been great at, even in Bell X1. Like, he has a few, like, I'm some tulip, there'll be no stopping me, get the house in order, you'll take someone's eye out. Like, these are just peppered throughout it. But delivered with just this, you know, this straight singer-songwriter face that you can't help but be charmed by that, I think.
And 9 songs and 40 minutes.
It's tight.
My favourite. As stars from you, Andrea.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I really, really hope that they continue to work together, because I think this sound is just what we need right now. It's a strong 4 for me.
A strong 4 from you, Andrea. What are you saying, Eamon?
Oh, yeah, definitely would echo that strong 4.
Strong 4.
I think
4.
It's certainly the strongest album this week.
All right. Dry Goods from Houseplants, a double 4 there from both Andrea and Eamon. Let's move on to album number 3, Public Service Broadcasting, an album called Bright Music. And this is a song that I would call The Rhythm Machine, but it's called Der Rhythmus Der Maschinen in this album. The Rhythm, the Machine, or Der Rhythmus, der Maschinen, from Public Service Broadcasting and their new album, Bright Music. Why are there German lyrics and German titles on this song, or on this album in general, Andrea?
Yeah, so this is the 4th record from this group. And if you're not familiar with Public Service Broadcasting, then a little primer. This is a band who have written concept albums around concepts like the National Space Centre and the rise and fall of the coal mining industry in Wales. So they've now taken Berlin as a kind of a historical concept and written in a way a love letter to it. This theme is a little bit looser than those other records, though. It's a bit more nebulous. Broadly, the focus is Berlin. J. Wilgoose Esquire, that is his name, calls it a fascinating, contrary and seductive place. And it's concerned with kind of Berlin as a history or a historical European capital of culture and music.
Is the album as fascinating and seductive as our friend thinks Berlin is?
I love Berlin. I love a lot of albums made in Berlin, and they've actually banged on about kind of like David Bowie's Low being a kind of key
and
influence.
Art pop is a label that's constantly thrown
and
at
look,
them.
They did it in Hanse in Kreuzberg, which were, you know, Octung Baby, Iggy Pop Records, Low. I could go on and on and on. One problem I do have with it, but I do think it's pretty good in places, and because I don't like early Public Service Broadcasting stuff at all. But in terms of that concept, it's very close, but in music and the concept, to the Manic Street Preachers' Futurology album, which they did in Berlin in the same studio. And indeed, James Dean Bradfield wasn't the last Public Service Broadcasting album. But, you know, putting that aside, there's some pretty, really good stuff here. And they've stopped being the one-trick pony of here's a sample of speech and here you have these kind of quite naff kind of instrumentation to go along with it. And it's certainly ambitious.
Well, that I hear it's ambitious, but so give me the but in terms of stars.
I give him a 3.
A 3. What are you saying, Andrea?
I think, look, in terms of what it's set out to be, which is a kind of a love letter to the city of Berlin, I think it works really well. It's experimental. I do like how nerdy this band are about, like, going out to the Leipziger Strasse with a wideband electromagnetic receiver to record electrical currents, because that was the place where Berlin had their first electric streetlight. great. I love all that.
Oh, great. And that means how many stars?
That's 3.5 stars.
Stars from Andrea Cleary. What did you say? 3, you said, Eamon, wasn't it? Yeah, for Public Service Broadcasting and their album Bright Music. Before that, we were speaking about Dry Goods from Houseplants, Grapefruit Season from James Vincent McMorrow. Andrea Cleary and Eamon Sweeney are two reviewers this evening. But that's our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. We have a special programme for you on Monday. We will be revealing the winners of this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. 7 o'clock on Monday here on RTE Radio 1.